This week on 9 to 5 Mac Happy Hour, we are joined by a very special guest, astronaut Garrett Reisman. He was selected by NASA. Yeah, hey! He was selected by NASA in 1988, and his first mission in space was aboard the Space Shuttle Endeavour in 2008, so 10 years later. Spent 95 days on a mission aboard the International Space Station. Second mission was aboard the Space Shuttle Atlantis in 2010. I saw Atlantis a few weeks ago over in Florida.
And how's she doing?
Doing good.
Okay.
And then, and you performed 3 spacewalks, operated the space station robot arm. You were a flight engineer aboard the space shuttle. And for this podcast, what we're interested in especially is that you're a technical consultant for the film Ad Astra, and more specifically for us, technical advisor for the TV show Apple TV Plus For All Mankind, which we are crazy about. We've talked about it weekly from the time it came out. Currently, Dr. Reisman is a professor at an astronautical engineering professor at the University of Southern California, a motivational speaker, senior advisor for Elon Musk rocket company SpaceX, and now 9 to 5 Mac Happy Hour's first guest in over 250 episodes.
Wow, that's a huge, that's a big deal, man. How come not until now, and how come me?
Well, we do other podcasts with guests, but for Happy Hour, it's just me and Benjamin talking about the week in Apple news every week. And there's never been a feeling of like having a guest before, but we were just one thing led to another, and we learned about you. And I was like, this would be really cool if it could come together and happen. And you were nice enough to join us, so I really appreciate that.
Well, I hope you're right. we'll find out soon enough.
Yeah. And I will say, if anyone hasn't seen For All Mankind, there will be spoilers ahead. We warned everyone last week to do their homework. And I've been rewatching it. It's so much fun. And before we get into that, I wanted to ask a few questions just because, oh my gosh, this is the first time I've spoken to an astronaut before. This is really cool.
I've spoken to a lot of them.
Yeah, I can imagine. I think I've got you down for over 20 hours of doing spacewalks at ISS. And I've spent my time of like watching the spacewalks happen over, 7 or 8 hours as they do. What is that feeling like? Because I can't imagine, and I know that you prepare for it ahead of time, but it just feels like looking at it unlike anything else on Earth, of course.
Oh, man. So. It's incredible. By far and away the highlight of my career, if not my life. I mean, those experiences of being able to go outside in that suit and have nothing but a glass helmet between you, which is like a fishbone. You almost forget it's there, by the way. So yeah. You kind of, so if you've ever gone scuba diving for a long period of time and you kind of forget that you're wearing a mask and you think you become one with your coral reef or whatever, it's like that.
It's like when you've wearing glasses for years on end and then you just kind of forget they're there.
Exactly. Yeah. That's another good analogy. Very good. So, yeah, you just forget that the helmet's there and it's just nothing between you and this entire planet. It's really remarkable. And just a sense of being out there, outside the vehicle, floating in space, and working in this crazy suit. It's just a remarkable experience. And the visuals are absolutely stunning. But you have to, the other part of this equation is that you're busy working.
Right.
Okay. And in fact, there's a tremendous amount of pressure, which tends to mar the sheer enjoyment of the moment, right? Because you have to get this job done. And you've been training for years to do this. And this is the hardest thing you as a mission specialist or astronaut are going to do on this mission. And you've got lots of people counting on you. It's extremely expensive, not only from a dollars and cents standpoint, but from a resource expenditure standpoint. So, and it's the most dangerous thing we do other than launching and entering. So the pressures that are on you as you're about to do this, I've never played professional athletics, just collegiate. Okay.
Yeah.
So I don't know for sure, but I've talked to people who are professional athletes and they kind of agree. Now they've never done the spacewalk, but we agree that it's similar to like going out to play for a championship, whether that be the World Cup, or the World Series or the Super Bowl or whatever your Stanley Cup, whatever your sport might be, as you're about to take the field, you know that you might only get one shot at this. You might only get one chance to compete in the finals of the World Cup in your whole career. And here it is in front of you. And whatever happens in the next couple hours is going to define you as a person, right? You're going to be old and sitting in a rocking chair and reflecting back to this moment.
Mm-hmm. You never forget it. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's, but here's the thing. You're going to be reflecting on this moment either with a tremendous sense of accomplishment that you won the championship, where you took your chance and you made it. Or you can be looking back at this with a tremendous sense of regret, right?
you blew it in mid-history for the wrong reasons.
Yeah,
so.
But whatever it is, it's something you're never going to forget. And so it's like that when you're about to go out to do the spacewalk. That's kind of what it feels like. And I could tell you a story. The most challenging spacewalk I ever did was the first one I did on my second mission. Mm-hmm. So the three spacewalks I did, it was the second one. It was just very, very difficult. The tasks we had to do, the timeline was very challenging. The complex interaction of the robotics and the spacewalking was very complicated. And getting everything to go right was going to be hard. And we really focused more on that whole mission. That was really the crux of the whole mission, was that one spacewalk. Hmm. And so I have all these thoughts going through my head. And my commander, who's suiting me up and about to put me in the airlock, could see by looking in my eyes, you know, this stress,
yeah,
and thoughts, because I'm kind of a goofball, so normally I'm joking around, but I'm not joking around at all at this moment.
Yeah,
Commander, what he did was he came up and he grabbed me in the suit by the shoulders, and there was a valve that was open that puts a hole through the helmet, and he came up over by that valve so I can hear him through my closed helmet, and he yelled really loud into that orifice. He yelled. While squeezing my suit as hard as he could, he said, "Got it! Don't up!"
Excellent.
And I just started laughing. Yeah. You know, and it was perfect. It was actually exactly what I needed to kind of break me out of that funk and not take myself too seriously. And so I guess that's why he was a commander. He knew exactly how to what to do. Yeah. But that's what it's like.
I mean, that sense of humor must come in use when you're in an environment that I guess could kill you. you really can't think about those factors. So, another question on that sort of specifically is timekeeping with that. Do you see what time it is and how long you've been on your spacewalk, or are you relying on like someone to tell you, or do you just not know and it's the job?
Yeah, you don't really have a watch,
right? Yeah,
But you have a whole giant team of people who are really very watching that clock very carefully.
Yeah.
Starting with we have one crew member who's on board, who's kind of like the choreographer, the manager, the coach, and they're the person that has a checklist and everything, and they have a clock right in front of them, so they're calling it out to you.
Yeah. Okay.
And then the ground, of course, is hyper aware of how much time. Not only how much time has elapsed, but also how much O2 you have left in the tanks,
sure,
how much more carbon dioxide scrubbing capability you have, and how much more water in the tanks to provide your cooling. So there's a lot of different clocks to look at, and they integrate them all and make sure that we don't bust. You know, it's not good to run out of oxygen.
Yeah, and they kind of show that in the show, like in the episode where they go down the crater on the moon, and the you know, he takes the woman's down there, and Ed Baldwin's like, "You've got to come up now. You've got to come up now." And you've got everyone in the space center at home telling them that their clocks are running out. They're running out of oxygen. So there's like that pressure of, you know, we've come all this way and we're not actually going to get anything out of it. But at the same time, you know, these are like our vital signs, essentially.
That scene was actually really realistic, because, like you said, it's exactly what I'm describing. And them, they have all the data. They know how much time is left. And they were getting very concerned. And the other thing that's very realistic about that is you never really want to come back inside that hatch.
Yeah.
You know,
want to do more work.
Yeah, you want to do more work, or you just want to have a moment to look one last time out at the Earth. You get so focused on doing the task that you almost can forget to, like, soak it in. And so one great piece of advice I got from a senior spacewalker is just make one or two moments along the way where you get a chance to really experience it. And I have certain, memories that will last forever. I remember kind of like Leo DiCaprio in Titanic, I'm holding on to the whole space station, which is behind me.
Yeah.
I'm on the very, very front tip. I can't see any of the space station in my field of view. And so for all I know, I'm alone up there. And I watched the sun come up over the horizon of the Earth. And
that's so cool.
That was spectacular. And I was very fortunate. My third spacewalk, I had great partners for all three, but on that third spacewalk, we were ahead of the schedule, mm-hmm. and the ground even ran out of stuff for us to do, which never happened.
Right.
And we knew that a mission, the pressure was off because we knew that we had made all of our main mission objectives at this point. And we got a chance to do stuff like, just to take a look at that sunrise. And we went up to the windows in the back of the space shuttle when we were inside the payload bay, and we knocked on the glass. The guys inside were like, oh, my God, there are aliens outside. Or whatever.
The closest I can relate is like going on a work trip to New York or California. And if I was ever going on just a vacation, it would be totally enjoyable. But because it's for work, you're thinking you don't get the time to stop and just – enjoy your environment. So it's not the same place, but I can appreciate what you're saying. And one more thing I want to mention before we get into the show too much is I saw as it broadcast the season finale, the series finale of the Colbert Report.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And so I was just kind of rewatching that this week, and then I rewatched your appearances there from when calling from space. And it's like, I guess my question here is like, what was it like being on that final episode? Because that's almost as amazing as Calling from Space, where you're like in the same room as like Willie Nelson and Peter Frampton and George Lucas and like all these people.
Yeah. That was incredible. That I described it as like the world's best cocktail party.
Yeah.
Where like there wasn't a single person in the room that you wouldn't like give a right arm to have a chance to talk with and hang out with, you know? Right. It was like, it wasn't just, you know, there were some like kind of A-list celebrities. There was like James Franco was there, and I'm trying to remember who else was like a big star. Patrick Stewart, I guess. Yeah. There were lots of them. But there was also like all the columnists from the New York Times.
Sure.
You know? And there was like Ben and Jerry from Ben and Jerry. And then there was like the artist that made the Hope poster for Obama. And it was like everybody. And I was hanging out for a while with Tim Meadows, who is Saturday Night Live comedian and actor. And we were talking and we were joking around that actually our biggest fear was, not talking to somebody there because we didn't know exactly who they were, and not discovering that I was standing right next to the guy that invented Wikipedia.
Yeah. Yes.
The time of day, you know,
that's right.
So we were terrified. I mean, you know, James Franco, you know, Willie Nelson, you know, and I was obvious because I was wearing my blue NASA jacket.
Yeah.
And Paulina Porizkova, she was pretty easy to pick out too. Yeah. There's Big Bird. You can't miss Big Bird, right?
That's right.
But there are other guys that like I was talking to this one guy, and it turns out it was Ed Vistris, who was a mountaineer who summited Everest and was a guy that rescued almost all those people. If you read Krakauer's book, Into Thin Air, about the tragedy that unfolded on Everest, he was a guy that went and dropped the IMAX camera and saved like a dozen people that day. And the stories he had were just incredible. And, yeah. You know, you'd walk right by him on the street. You have no idea.
Right.
So it was incredible.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. So can you just give us an overview to start with of what your kind of role is as a technical advisor on For Mankind?
It's incredibly broad, which I love. Right. So it started out, I was in the writer's room as they were first coming up with a very basic idea. So Ron Moore and Ben and Matt are executive producers, plus all the writers.
Yeah.
We have, it's really funny. It's this building in Burbank, California. And it looks like a completely nondescript office building. Like you would go in there, like maybe to go visit your orthodontist or your accountant or something, right? and you walk in and then suite 201, instead of being an orthodontist, it just says 201. You open the door and inside there's like all these Keurig machines and beanbag chairs and pictures of Apollo stuff all over all the walls. And that's the writer's room for All Mankind. And that's where all the magic happens. And it turned, like, as I was leaving, I looked at suite 202 and it just said 202. And one of the guys said, oh, you know, that's where we write Outlander. So you're in there and you have all these whiteboards. And we were from the very beginning sketching out not only season one, but like a lot of seasons, whole story arc. And then eventually they all had their own, each season had one whiteboard, and then we got to season one and each episode had its own whiteboard and got more and more granular as we started working. And then they started writing scripts, and I reviewed every single script line by line and, gave them, you know, notes on everything. And then they start shooting, and then I get questions from, you know, it's great because I get to interact with like the prop guys. So they'll be like, hey, there's a stick that you use on the space shuttle. If you can't reach the controls, what does that look like? How is it? How, do we still have a picture of it? Is it 18 inches? You know, how do you, when do you use it? And I get questions from like the hair and makeup people. Like, what do the women do with their hair when they do a spacewalk? And I'm like, you're asking the wrong person, but I got friends that can nice. So it's all kinds of, you know, the stunt guys are like, okay, we're simulating walking on the moon and we just got these wires. How do we do that? So
yeah,
you work with the stunt guys, you work with the art department, and then you start shooting and you work with the actors. And I met with all the principal cast before their first shot. And yeah, so I could give them advice on like how to basically fake like you're in zero gravity and just give them a feel for what their characters are thinking at different moments. And so you work with the cast and then you show up on set and you watch them film and you're like, yeah, that, you know,
sort of
couldn't really reach that under 6 G's, you know, that kind of thing. And then you help them shoot it again and you try to get as much of it right as you can. And then it goes into post-production and then you're trying to help out, with the guys doing the visual effects and the audio effects. So the cool thing is this job, I get to see the entire production from the very first, very beginnings to the end and everything in between. And so it's fascinating. And it's also all that stuff that I just described are things that as a mechanical engineer, I would never in a million years ever really be a part of. Right.
Right. Yeah.
So I described this experience to people. I was like, you know, like you can go to like these fantasy baseball camps or guitar camps.
Yeah.
Where you like get to play catch with the New York Yankees, or you get to play guitar with like, I don't know, Eddie Van Halen or somebody. Yeah. Right. And it's like, they treat you like an equal, even though, you know, you're not, but you paid a lot of money to go to this camp, you know? Yeah. So it's kind of like that, where I get to like do these things with these people who are at the top of the game, like Ron Moore.
Yeah.
That guy has made some of my favorite shows. And he, man, these guys that really, the writers, everybody working on the show, the cameramen, the visual effects guys are at the top of their game in the whole industry. And you get to work with them like you belong there. And that cracks me up all the time.
Yeah.
So you were there from the very beginning, which was, that must have been what, like late 2017, early 2018 timeframe?
Let me think. It would have been this, it was right after I left SpaceX. Mm-hmm. So that would have been, summer 2018, yeah,
so around that. Because I think one of, like, this show's like so timely as well, in that, you know, we're on the precipice, like, for you know, at least most of my lifetime, I'm 25, like, space has been kind of out of the picture, really, and only in the last few years kind of is it really, like, we're back on the, you can feel it with your fingertips almost, that we're probably going to go back to the moon, and we're going to have, you know, launches from America hopefully in the next year or so. Like, it's kind of crazy how it's all come together, and the show kind of like celebrates that as well as the history as well, right? Like, it's the timely moment.
You know, it's interesting that the very first involvement I had with the show was I got a call from Ron Moore one day, and he said, hey Garrett, I'm thinking about doing another space show. I'd like to bounce some ideas off of you, which thrilled me that he would think to call me and do that. So I invited him to come down to SpaceX, and we actually had lunch right in the SpaceX cafe. I gave him a tour of the whole place first, and then we sat down and had lunch. And I got two ideas. One is like to do basically a Mad Men, a period piece, but set at NASA in the 70s. So instead of, you know, Madison Avenue and a bunch of mid-century modern furnishings, we would have 70s lapels and it'd be set at NASA. Uh-huh. And I said, oh, that sounds cool. And they said, but then I'm also talking about this idea of doing an alternate history where things are different, and the Russians, you know, beat us to the moon. And I said, oh my God, that's such an awesome idea. I immediately fell in love with that premise. And the more we talked about it, I think the more he fell in love with it. And then he pitched that to Apple, and now we have For All Mankind. So
yeah,
like, it was caught up in that whole, like you're saying, about how things are really, no pun intended, taking off right now.
Yeah, like me personally, I've always been sort of interested in space. Just like, you know, if you ask me if I like space, yeah, it's cool. You know, I'm like more, I think space is cooler than, like, I don't know, tennis or something, but I've not ever been super just enthusiastic and knowledgeable. And it's kind of because it's felt like history, something that happened way before I was born, and just things that are not happening on the news today. And so it doesn't feel like it's the future. And so this, like, 2018 was pretty impressionable on me, because you had Apollo 50, the 50th anniversary of Apollo 11 and the moon landing. And just for that reason, like for, you know, one day in the middle of the summer, we're all thinking about the moon landing again. And so I went to the Infinity Science Center near where I live in South Mississippi. And it's like my first time there. And it turns out they've got this whole museum that's like, you know, it's right across the street from Stennis Space Center. It's like a real space center with like history, you know. And then I've lived here all my life, and like I learned that there's like the Mishu plant, you know, where they make engines and all this stuff. And so that was cool. But then a few months go by, and that is kind of it. And then For All Mankind comes out, and I'm really into it. I got invited from NASA Social to go see a SpaceX Falcon 9 launch down in Florida. So that was really cool. And just being around like space people, they all knew a lot about what they're talking about. And to me, like, if you were talking about Apple, I would be that way. But with space stuff, I was learning things like, you know, about Space Launch System and Artemis and things that was brand new to me. Or even like SpaceX, what it was and how long it's been around. Like I would have thought, you know, maybe 8 or 10 years and not, you know, since the early 2000s. So, having all this stuff be, you know, historical anniversaries are cool, but having it be in the pop culture, you know, and seeing like For All Mankind introduce it in a way that's like relatable.
It's like brought back into the public eye.
Yeah. It's really neat. Yeah.
Well, it's really interesting that, and by the way, you haven't seen anything yet.
Cool.
This year, I predict, is going to be a really big turning point.
Yeah.
Because it's just crazy. All these things are going on, and it just so happens that all the stars are aligning, all the schedules are aligning. It looks like everything's going to happen this year.
Yeah.
So I think SpaceX and Boeing will first have their first crew flights this year. Mm-hmm. I think the same thing will be true for Blue Origin and Virgin as well.
Yeah.
So all of a sudden, you're going to have four companies operating out of the U.S. that are going to be sending people into space when, you know, right now we have zero.
Right.
So it's going to be an unbelievably exciting year. And you already mentioned NASA and Artemis and everything they're doing. So 2020, we're going to look back at 2020, I predict, and say that's when everything really got moving.
Yeah. And it's so cool that that's all happening with For All Mankind. And like, you know, you mentioned that there are seasons to come. I think Ron Moore's mentioned that he's got like, you know, at least 7 seasons already like, you know, planned out. So that's really cool. And I've, you know, I'll just mention here for the first time publicly that I've pitched our publisher on a space site because we've got an Apple vertical, a Google vertical, green energy with Tesla and with our electric site. And I've been, you know, just from the seeing a rocket launch in person and then learning all this stuff about it, it's like a lot of stuff happened over the last decade that I didn't know about and I was alive for it, like history. And I didn't know a whole lot about the space shuttle program. And because I was like 10, 12, you know, and like my memories are like, you know, 9/11 happened. I have memories of like playing Pokemon and like my friends in, you know, middle school, things like that. But, you know, not history as it was happening. It's like we've got to start covering this stuff from our perspectives, because like we're about to see a lot of cool history play out in real time.
That's right. That's right. And as you're mentioning, with regard to For All Mankind, it's really fascinating to see the interplay between science fiction and science fact. And the very first time I spoke to Ron Moore, it was from the space station. I was up on the space station. The way this whole, my relationship with him began was, they ask you when you're up there, are there any celebrities you'd like to talk to? Like, and then it's kind of as a morale booster, they will go, you know, arrange phone calls. And I said, yeah, I want to talk to Ron Moore and David Icke, the creators of Battlestar Galactica, which at the time was like my favorite show.
Yeah.
And we had this great conversation basically over Skype from the space station. And we talked about how we were both, like, I was inspired by Star Trek and Star Wars and then later Battlestar. And that led me into inspire me to do what I do as far as being an astronaut and being an engineer. And Ron was saying that he was inspired by Apollo and shuttle to do what he did, which was become, you know, a writer and a creator of Battlestar Galactica and Star Trek and this kind of really neat give and take or yin and yang play between fact and fiction and how we inspire each other. And then I invited him to come to my last launch. And so in 2010, he was down there.
Yeah.
And he wrote this great description of what it was like to stand there and watch the space shuttle take off. So we've been kind of going back and forth between fact and fiction. And now Apple is paying both of us to. That's great.
I like a lot of like sci-fi, but For All Mankind's really kind of the first like alternate history show, because as much of it is like made up for the drama. There's also a lot of it that's like grounded in reality, or reality that's, you know, 20 years ahead of what the timeline is. Like even the start, even the premise of the show where the, like the Soviets land on the moon first, like that's not completely out there, right? That was, you know, possible.
In fact, that initial conversation with Ron at SpaceX, I told him how I was in Moscow and I saw flight hardware that they had built for their lunar lander. So they were much further along than most Americans of the West really knew at the time and even appreciate today. They were closer than we thought to challenging us. And I think that the fact that it could have happened inspired him. I think like what you're saying, by the way, you know, with For All Mankind is we want the audience to have the reaction like, okay, we know this didn't happen,
yeah,
but it could have, right? As long as it's plausible that like, oh, it could have gone this way. That's where we're aiming for.
Yeah, I just from being exposed to all this and just being really interested now, I took a rocket class over the weekend that was the history of rockets over at the Infinity Science Center. And part of the class, they gave us a printout of the space race timeline. It's like a column for the Soviet Union, a column for the U.S. And there's like so much stuff in the Soviet Union column that came before anything for the U.S. or just like by comparison. It's like, you know, it really was a race. It wasn't just a given. And so taking that and the show, it's like this, you know, when you're watching it as news, like, and you're living it, then it's like, you know, it you don't know how it's going to go. And so that's part of what helps the show, I think, is that like, if you don't know the history very well, it's like, then you can kind of go back and learn like how close it really was. And then there's even things from the show where if you know history, then this like, you know, sort of like inside jokes of the show, like it went differently this way, you know, with Benjamin being in the UK, I asked him, it was like, you know, with the Chappaquiddick situation, like, were you familiar with that? Like, you know, learning in the UK,
US politics. So no idea.
There's certain little things in there that are kind of Easter eggs that not everybody's going to get, but then there, you know, there are other larger geopolitical stuff that, that comes out, especially, I gotta keep catching my tongue because we're shooting development too right now.
Sure. Yeah. But one of the things that like illuminated me was like the von Braun stuff with the, you know, the German connection, and like when I saw that in the show, my like instinct reaction was, oh, they've just kind of like added that in as, you know, backstory of like, you know, entertainment to cause some conflict and stuff. But you know, that's like grounded in truth again.
Totally. I mean, remember that scene where they bring out those photographs in the conference chamber or committee chamber? Those were real photographs. That was not our art department. And in fact, the interlude where the fellow playing the piano was singing that song about von Braun. That's real footage. That's archival footage that, you know, so yeah, all that stuff was actually about von Braun was sadly very accurate.
Yeah. Yeah. It's something like with sci-fi, you know, I enjoy sci-fi, but with this sort of crossover genre of like alternative, history, it's like you can look at it and appreciate it and then go back and like, it's fun to find out what was real, what wasn't real. And actually learn the history because, you know, you can know a little bit about it, but you know, when you learn a lot about it, it's like, wow. And then you've got a new appreciation for the show. So it's neat. Yeah.
Especially in the early parts of season one, like when they're talking about Apollo 10, could they have landed? Right.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
That was all very, very, even the numbers that are bandied about how much fuel and how much weight are right on the money, you know, carefully researched and accurate. And so especially in the beginning, now the further we go along, and now we're in season two, and as we progress, it's going to diverge more and more, and because we'll get beyond, eventually we'll get beyond the current day, we hope. If Apple sticks with us and keeps having us continue, and then of course we have more liberties, and even in season two, it's easier to say, well, in our alternative universe, this and that, because we're diverging more and more. But but season one especially, we worked really, really hard to be very, very close to actual, because our divergence from actual history was still very slight at that point.
It was only like offset by a few years, or like things that happened in smaller scale were taken to a big thing, like the woman in like in space program, wasn't there something in like the 60s where there was a
In fact, so our character Molly Cobb was based on a real person.
Mm-hmm.
Jerry Cobb, I think, if memory serves me correctly. So we couldn't get the rights to use her actual name. We wanted to make her an historical figure, just like we have a Neil Armstrong and a Buzz Aldrin and an Alexei Leonov, and that these are all real people. We wanted to have the real Jerry Cobb, but anyway, that didn't work out. So we have Molly Cobb, but yeah, she's based on this person and was part of this this group of women that right around the time of the Mercury program at the Lovelace Clinic were put through the same test. And it's a fascinating story in and of itself. And that all happened, and then it got shut down by politics, basically, and society, saying that now we don't want women. And the excuse was that they weren't test pilots. But they passed, you know, all the same physical tests, and they had, and so, you know, a lot of what goes on in the show is also, some of it is, you know, especially with the geopolitical tensions, are things that go worse than actually what really happened. But some of it is also like saying, well, if we lived in, if our better angels prevailed, maybe it would have been like this. And so there's a little bit of that that goes on in the show, I think.
Yeah, even just jumping to the post-credit sequence where I finished the last show like the hour it came out, and then I went to bed, and Benjamin was like, did you see the post-credit sequence? And I said, no, I didn't. So I had to go back and like rewatch it on Apple TV Plus. And, you know, that ship coming out of the water, like I watched it, and they sent me the link of like, this is – you know, it didn't happen, obviously, but this is what that reference is, you know. It's like a...
Yeah, the sea dragon thing.
The sea dragon.
Yeah.
The sea dragon. Yeah, we based on a real development project that never got built. So, yeah, we never actually did launch a giant rocket like that out of the ocean. But a lot of the engineering analysis was done. And that was, it never made it all the way to prototyping. But the research was there to say, hey, this could be done. It was based on a real project,
So
a lot of the stuff we do is all based on things that maybe didn't happen, but really, really could have happened or were planning to have happened.
Yeah. That's something that I'm really excited about the show because, you know, I can talk to my family. We're watching the show together, my wife and my kids, and we can talk about it and like say, this is the history. This is what's, you know, they're playing with, as alternative history. And it's kind of just cool to have For All Mankind be a conversation point of talking about the topic. And I can't wait to see where it goes in season two and beyond, you know, because like, you know, real things that happen. The sort of the premise of the show is that you can, like, if reality was more interesting than alternative history, then there wouldn't be a need for the show. But I think the reality is that, you know, the space race did end, and you can say what could have happened if it didn't, and then this is the show. But you do get to a point like when we're in history where we haven't seen the show yet, where the space shuttle program is really interesting, and like it's having, you know, I've been learning a lot more about it lately just because I did live through a lot of the years, but I was young and don't have recollection. And so just learning is like, wow, that really is astonishing that we've got this, like this glider and this, you know, this machine, and like there's a number of them. And, you know, I can't wait to see when you start to mix the show with, you know, alternative history, but also the amazing things that we did do before you even get to the, you know, future beyond where you are today.
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting. The shuttle is the most remarkable flying machine we've ever come up with. It can launch like a rocket, land like an airplane, do a spacewalk out of it. It's got robot arm, can carry up Hubble Space Telescope in its trunk, you know, all kinds of stuff like that. And the remarkable thing is to think it was designed in the 70s, right?
Right.
It's incredible that and we today we're not even building anything that could do all those things. So and the station also, you know, space station is also another incredible achievement. And when you're going up to the space station and you're docking with it in the shuttle, it dwarfs the shuttle. It's kind of like the Death Star, you know.
Yeah.
It's not a moon, you know. It's like a huge thing, and it's really incredible. But at the same time, we wanted more. You know, when I say we, I mean the people that grew up during Apollo. Expected more, I should say, and because the you extrapolate from Apollo and what we did in 10 years time, and then you know if you keep going, you think, oh, we're going to be living on Mars by now, and we're not, right?
Right.
So there's this kind of sense of disappointment that things didn't go further, and that is in large part was driving Ron to imagine the show to kind of say, well, at least in fiction. we want to think about what could have been.
Yeah.
And also, it's interesting that like Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk and Richard Branson are driven by that same thing, by that sense of a bit of a sense of disappointment that we didn't go further, and a sense of urgency as they are getting older to say it's time, we got to do it now. Yeah. Let's get on with it. And that's to a large extent why there's, like, as we talked about in the beginning of the podcast, that there's so many incredible things happening
right now.
All the show and SpaceX and Blue Origin are really all driven from the same sense of loss that these guys all felt.
A lot of stuff happened really fast. And then, you know, like you mentioned, space shuttle designed in the 70s, and then that carries us through the 2010, you know, time frame. And then now, and as far as I knew, like, this, you know, space shuttle, and that was it. And we have no new plans, and it's whatever private companies are doing. And only from exposure to For All Mankind and seeing a rocket launch do I learn about Space Launch System and, like, how long that's been talked about and planned and
changed,
and how it ties to politics, and how it, you know, you get numbers like, you know, it launching by 2019, and then that went away, and now we're in 2020. And, you know, I feel fortunate that I can, down the street there's Cinis and there's the core stage. It's like, that's really cool. That's like history right now.
Yeah, you probably hear that thing when the thing lights up. That's going to make a lot of noise.
That's right.
Invest in some good earplugs.
Yeah, and I'm so happy that I'm learning about this now and not whenever it is history, because, you know, you can't go back. It's like, but just how, even when NASA can give a time frame of, we want to, you know, have the first woman and next man land on the moon by 2024, like, you know, until it happens, until there's money behind it, and it's like, you know, on the news, you're not really sure yet. You know, it's not started, and things are just likely to move back, you know, to take longer than expected, or, you know, hopefully gets funded. So, but it's neat. Like, the seeing this become part of the pop culture is really cool. And, like, I don't know, from your perspective, what is the last decade for you feel like, you know, when the shuttle program is retired, and then it's think we're just kind of in a planning stage for a long time.
Well, when that decision was made, it was very bittersweet, because, you know, I remember standing there looking up at Atlantis, realizing she's only going to fly maybe one more time.
Yeah.
And when she's sitting on the runway and she's still, you know, venting and making all and her machinery is all still turning, you realize there's a lot of life left in that vehicle.
Yeah.
And sure enough, we only, you know, those airframes were certified for, I think, 100 missions, and none of them came anywhere close to reaching that. So there was a lot left. But at the same time, when I talked before about how incredible the shuttle is and how we might in our lifetimes never see a machine as capable of doing all those things in one machine.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it did all those things. And there were two negative consequences. One was money. The shuttle was ridiculously expensive to maintain.
Yeah.
We were spending, I think, $3 billion a year just to keep it going, whether we launched it or not, just keeping the standing army together and all the facilities that were required for to make that program run. That's a lot of money. And then on top of that, it also, because it was so complex and so expensive, it also wasn't the safest. You know, we lost two of them, and we could do better than that. So I think that the decision to stop when we did, as painful as it was the right decision. I do believe that. And I think that finally the proof of that will come this year when we have two new vehicles flying to replace it, and hopefully with a much greater safety and a much more cost effective vehicles. And so that will be the reward from this painful gap that we had to go through of not flying.
Yeah, it's kind of a neat parallel where For All Mankind, the premise is, what if Russia won the space race, landed on the moon first, then where would it take us? Sort of the history that we're in now is, what if space shuttle ends and then America doesn't have a vehicle to launch into space, you know, Americans into space, and we've got to rely on Russia, then what happens? And kind of the answer to that is, well, you've got SpaceX and you've got, you know, Boeing working on their thing. And it's like, that's kind of the happening today, like the alternative history of, like, you know, you can imagine space shuttle gets replaced with something bigger and better. But in reality now we've got, you know, what, Falcon 9 and Falcon Heavy and the Starship, you know, big things coming. It's like, you know, we've got entertainment with For All Mankind and alternative history. And it just helps you appreciate what we're actually living through today that I don't think a lot of, like, I don't think it's quite mainstream enough yet that, you know, I talk to my family and like, as I'm learning things, I'm like, am I just an idiot and didn't know this stuff? Or does no, like, do people just not know this yet? It's like, we have no idea what you're talking about. And I feel good about it, you know? But it's neat. I think For All Mankind too will continue to serve that purpose of like, you know, a jumping off point. You know, you watch the show together, you enjoy it with your family, and then you can say, by the way, this is what's going on today, or, you know, plans and everything.
Yeah. And again, I'm restricted in what I can tell you with regard to spoilers, but I can predict for you that as we go forward into season two and beyond, that it'll get more and more relevant to the present day. And I think that that's going to be pretty cool.
That's awesome.
That's all I can say.
Yeah.
So obviously, you know, as a technical advisor, you are like a stickler for the facts, right? But at some point you have to balance, like, you know, having the entertaining show versus actually being like directly connected to what it would be feasible and what would be possible. Was there anything you can think of in like season one where, you know, you really had to put your foot down and you were like, I really want this to be this way? Or was there something where you're like, oh, it's better, you know, better if we go off course, like that kind of thing?
Oh yeah, there are examples in both directions. So for example, the original for episode 9, that whole kind of rescue thing, the original idea was that for that to happen in between the Earth and the Moon. And I had to say, like, that's really not practical. Even if you had a launch vehicle stacked on the pad, ready to go at a moment's notice, and something happens between the Earth and the Moon, you can't catch up. You can't, like, go faster and then have it, because the vehicle is designed to go at a certain speed. You can't speed up. Because then you have to slow down. Otherwise, you're just going to go blow by the moon and use up all your propellant. Sure. And you don't have the propellant to slow down. So that doesn't work. So then I said, well, what if the emergency happens in Earth orbit? Well, they could keep going around for a while they have time to mount, a second flight. And so that's how the story of episode 9 kind of changed. So that's an example in that direction. In the other direction, there's lots of things that I've come to appreciate where there's real world constraints. For example, you got a cast that's a certain size, and you can't, and those actors need to work with each other. So you have this ensemble cast, and they need to be in the same scenes. You can't have them. So I said, like, you know, we have the NASA administrator spending a lot of time in mission control, you know, directly influencing. Sure. And that's not entirely false. There were, in the early days, some examples of that, but by and large, the administrators in DC and Wernher von Braun, for that matter, he was, you know, responsible for the Saturn V, he was over in Huntsville at Marshall. He wasn't like attending Sims in the mission control room at Johnson Space Center and supervising, you know, helping young flight controllers become flight directors. And that was like, he had nothing to do with any of that.
Yeah.
But the thing was that if you had these actors and Wernher von Braun was over at Marshall the whole time and never was in the room with the other actors, you can't have a show. So that was an example where, like, okay, I know that's not really real, but let's just go with it because, you know, we have, at the end of the day, you're making a TV show, not a documentary.
Yeah.
So the other thing is for me that's very important is that the thing that people will come, like for example, on Ad Astra, we also had some violations of orbital mechanics. And when we premiered that, I had a bunch of my USC students were actually there, and in the lobby afterwards, they were grousing about, because they were all a bunch of nerds like I am, and they were grousing about one of the orbital mechanics violations. And I had to look at him and said, listen, nobody decides to go see a movie for the orbital mechanics. They go see a movie for the story, for the cinematography, for the acting. There's no Academy Award for orbital mechanics. The last time I checked, there's no Oscar given out in that category. So, yeah, you have to, you don't want to violate it so bad that the audience has a hard time suspending their disbelief and it becomes laughable. You don't want to violate it like that. But at the same time, you don't want to be such a stickler for the truth that you end up making a boring story. Because at the end of the day, it's the story that's the most important thing.
Yeah, I think for Benjamin and myself, like the closest we can relate to that understanding is if we can look at like an app design or a product design and know if it's good or bad, and we can see like a bigger average of people not care about smaller details. So I imagine for you, like, and people like you, like your students, you watch a movie, you see things that we cannot see. And so it's got to change the viewing experience. And I've seen you rate movies based on like how realistic things are.
Yeah. I didn't used to be that way. I mean, apparently Neil Armstrong was that way. There was a great talk I heard from his kids about like they hated watching any kind of science fiction movie with their dad because he complained like, woe be it onto the set design. If there was one instrument that was in the wrong position on an aircraft cockpit instrument panel, that he would be furious. And they're like, Dad, I'm just trying to watch the movie. And he'd be like, they specifically said Battlestar Galactica.
Yeah.
Since it's Neil, I'm thinking it was the original Battlestar Galactica, but he's like, why are they putting these spaceships in these catapults like it's on an aircraft carrier and launching them, you know? Yeah. They're in space. They don't have to get a certain airspeed to get airborne. They can just plop them out, and it would be fine.
You know?
And they're like, yeah, okay. And I never used to be like that. I like the movie Gravity a lot, and that thing violated the laws of physics terribly. Compelling story, right?
Yeah.
But now that I have this job, I find myself, because now I'm like training myself to do it. I find myself being more and more critical and like looking for those little things. I catch myself sometimes when I'm watching other science fiction. And I'm like, stop doing that. Just enjoy the show. You know? Don't drive yourself crazy.
You can understand why it's made that way. Yeah.
Like one kind of question I had on that kind of thing is in the show, obviously, attitudes towards gay people and LGBTQ were not the same in the 60s and 70s they are today. But what we see in the show is a depiction of like a fake wedding where they try and pretend to be a straight couple to stay in the space program. Does that have a basis in history, or is that, you know, like brought in?
It's hard for me to remember. I told a lot of stories in the writer's room, and it's hard for me to know. Some of that stuff kind of evolved and got incorporated in some of our story. But one of the stories I told was that there was my Russian instructor when I was at JSC. And at the time, in Texas, you know, even just 10 years ago, it was different, as far as attitudes towards LGBTQ.
Yeah.
And certainly, there was no same sex marriage anywhere in the US, if I remember correctly, but certainly not in Texas. So what I did was I flew, promise rings for him and his partner. Mm-hmm. And I flew these two rings up to the space station, took a photograph of them floating with the Earth in the background. When I came back, I went to a ceremony. It couldn't be a wedding,
right?
Because that would be illegal. But we had a promise ceremony that was a wedding ceremony and everything but name and legality.
Yeah.
And I presented those rings at the ceremony. Awesome. I gave them their rings and they put them on. And so that was something I was very proud of. And I told that story, and that story about attitudes in my era at NASA, I think in some way turned into a little bit the story of the Wilsons.
Yeah, that's something that's interesting about the show is stuff that can feel like ancient history, like the way things were 10 years ago can feel like it's something of the 70s, you know, but really it's the 2010s and like the 2000s and 2010s were not as modern as last year. It really does. Change takes a long time.
It does. It does. But the fact that it is so different just 10 years later is a very good thing.
Yeah, totally.
We're heading in the right direction. And I just hope we keep heading that way because obviously there's counter forces.
Indeed. Yeah.
Kind of one more point on a kind of thing we see in the show where Ed Baldwin's left on his own, which I assume would never happen in real life, right? You wouldn't leave the astronaut on his own in space, on the base.
You know, I don't know what we would do in such a crazy scenario like what happens in I guess it's episode 8. So I can't say never, but certainly the plan is always to at least
never have
anybody alone. Even when we do spacewalks, it's always a pair of two that go out.
Right.
So, we would, it was certainly something that we would try very, very hard to avoid.
Yeah. And then kind of the result of that is obviously his child unfortunately dies, but he's unaware because he's disconnected in space. And that's like a big part of the show, is where you have the like information asymmetry between the ground and up there. And they have this big, like, almost sinister debate about whether we should tell him, whether we should not tell him. And that was one of the big points which caused a like conversation in our family about, you know, would you want to know? And,
sure.
You know, this is a bit of a personal question, but you're an astronaut. Like, do they ask you that kind of thing? Do they check? Do you want to know if something terrible happened while you're out, you know, while you're up there, or would you wait till you came home?
Yeah, I remember, I think the chief of the office asked me that at one point before I went up for my space station mission. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we've had this kind of thing happen. We had a crew member on the space station who lost his mother mm-hmm. to a vehicle accident while he was up in space. Mm-hmm. We had guys having to process 9/11 and being able to see it out the window, sure. You know, from the space station. So we've dealt with similar things. It never got to the point of the asymmetry where it became a sense of betrayal and trust but I could see at the same time, there's also a large deference paid to the family and their wishes. So the way it all played out is not inconceivable, although I think it would be really, really hard to blatantly tell falsehoods to somebody up on orbit. Yeah. In order to cover up what was happening. But at the same time, I could see it'd be hard to counter what the spouse thought was best course of action. Mm. Tough. Yeah. I hate, you know, we're going to have to deal with that. You know, it's going to happen again.
Right.
And we don't really have a protocol that's like written in. There's no like procedure with that.
There's no law. Right. Yeah.
You know, son, death, contingency, step right. one, inform, you know, there's none of that.
And it's personal for everyone, kind of, what they kind of prefer and how they'd react.
Yeah, yeah. You go with the people at the time and the judgment of the management, and the psychologist. There's a whole team of NASA flight surgeons and psychologists that would advise you in that situation too.
Yeah.
And that kind of gray area is what makes it such an, you know, poignant and interesting part of the actual narrative as well.
Yeah. Something else that I appreciate about the show is that you do lose people, like people die, you know, not just his child, but people that work in the program, within the show. And when you look at NASA history, it happened, like people die, like the Apollo mission that explodes from Florida. Like I was watching the Apollo documentary and I, again, like just forgive my ignorance, but just you don't study it this deeply in school to know. Every single mission, and just like I'm watching it and they're showing the astronauts, and then it's a documentary, so it's real, but I don't see it coming, and they actually die. It's like, wow, you know. And I was doing the same thing with the shuttle documentary. It's like, you know, I know history somewhat vague, but I don't know in detail, and the same thing happened. Just like it's in that case it's real, but it catches you off guard. It's like, you know, people actually die, like they lose their life to this program. And, you know, seeing that depicted in the show, I think if you didn't have that, would be too bad. And so, you know, once you learn the history, you really have an appreciation for it. And so I imagine this kind of, that has to be a part of the show too.
Yeah, it does. It does. I mean, there's been plenty of tragedy along with the triumphs, both in the Russian program and in the American program. The American one, the Apollo 1, Challenger, Columbia are better known, but the Russians lost two Soyuz missions, and they had their N1 rocket. One of the things that kept them from beating us to the moon was they had an explosion on the pad of this enormous rocket that killed a lot of the engineers because they were too close to it when it went up. And yeah, there's plenty of, it's not only the human missions tragedies, but I was watching, I forgot the episode where we have the explosion on the pad.
Yeah. Oh yeah, like five, yeah.
Five, yeah. I was watching that with my former boss of vice president at SpaceX.
Okay.
and he was getting some bad flashbacks to, we lost one of our Falcon 9s on the pad.
Yeah.
It exploded and wasn't as dramatic and there was no loss of life, but it was still heartbreaking at the time.
It's still a loss. Yeah.
Is that what you want to see?
PTSD when he was watching that episode, you know, right. He's like, ooh, that's a little too close to home.
And, yeah.
It does. Unfortunately, it is a risky business. There's no question. Like Gus Grissom in Apollo 1, he said that, and he's right. You know, we're gonna see that in the show as well.
Mayo, anything else for me?
I think that's good. I mean, it's a bit of a sad note to end on, but obviously the show is as much about like positivity as it's about showing, you know, the bad sides and the realities of the world, isn't it? Like, that's just what it is.
Yeah, I mean, it's just drama. It's life.
And it's so cool that it's a TV show because, you know, because we've got 10 episodes in the first season and they're all about an hour long, a little bit under an hour. It's like a movie would be 2-3 hours and you just couldn't fit this much information and like the personal stories of people in. And that really does a good service for people that live through it. And I can't wait to see more.
Well, I can't wait to show it to you. Season 2 has been a tremendous amount of fun and I think it's coming together really nicely. So please tune in when it comes out. I don't know when that's going to be, but whenever it is, I'm very happy with how it's coming along. So it's working on this show has been a real treat for me. I have a lot of really exciting moments, but along the way. And I probably could sit here and tell you stories all day.
is there anything that you want viewers, if you haven't seen the show, to look for in the show or like a reason to watch it, or if you do view it, you know, something that you want people to take away from it?
Well, I hope to take away from it just like, that really what it's designed to do is to show you what it could have been like and what it still can be like.
Sure.
If we really dedicate ourselves to exploring space and we realize the promise of what we're capable of doing and focus our efforts on that rather than on a lot of the more divisive things that we're spending our time on today without getting too political. So I think hopefully that people watch it, they're like, oh wow, this is really interesting, and I hope that we take these bold steps, and our real history is as exciting to watch develop as the show going forward. So I hope that's the case. One other thing to mention that's kind of fun is how we do play a little bit with the technology. The idea is that by spending all this effort on space exploration, that technology progresses in our alternative universe faster than it did in reality.
Sure.
So you'll start seeing things like personal computers showing up earlier than they did.
Nice.
So each season we kind of calibrate it like, okay, now we're like 3 years ahead of actual time, and now we're like 5 years ahead. So we're going to keep ramping that up. And
that
so
makes
when
sense.
We do get to the present day, our present day is going to be a more glorious technical future than what we experience in reality. So that's going to be interesting when we catch up to real time.
Oh man, we're so sold on this. Can't wait to see it. All right. Well, Dr. Reisman, thank you so much for joining. This has been an absolute pleasure. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. It was fun for me too. And good luck to you guys. And if you do start that space show, let me know.
I'd be cool
to check that out.
Totally. Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right, that is the 9 to 5 Mac Happy Hour podcast for this week. We hope you enjoyed the interview as much as we did. And Benjamin and I will be back next week with our usual rundown and analysis of the week in Apple News. In the meantime, you can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at ApolloZack. That's ApolloZack. And Benjamin is on Twitter at BZAMayo. If you're new to 9 to 5 Mac Happy Hour, we hope you subscribe and stick around for more episodes. And if you're already a subscriber and want to support the podcast, please just share it with someone you know. We really appreciate that. You can also learn more about astronaut Garrett Reisman at garrettreisman.com. That's GarrettReisman.com. Or follow Dr. Reisman on Twitter at AstroGDog. That's Astro, A-S-T-R-O, _, G, D-O-double-G. Tremendous thanks again to astronaut Reisman for joining us on 9 to 5 Mac Happy Hour. And be sure to check out the full first season of For All Mankind on Apple TV+. All 10 episodes are available now on Apple TV+ for $4.99 per month after a 7-day free trial. A 1 year is included when you purchase a new iPhone, iPad, iPod Touch, Mac, or Apple TV, and service is included for free with the Apple Music student plan. Apple TV Plus is available to watch on iPhone, iPad, Apple TV, Mac, or with AirPlay on the web and on the Apple TV app for Samsung Smart TVs, Roku players and TVs, and Fire TV sticks and TVs, and coming soon to LG, Sony, and Vizio Smart TVs. For All Mankind has already been renewed for a second season on Apple TV+, so look forward to new episodes coming later in the future. With that being said, we'll be back next week. Bye, everybody.